Good afternoon. We are here on number S1SC41150, State v. Carter. Ms. Ryan, I see that you've reserved 15 minutes in rebuttal. Is that correct?
Yes. That's
great. Will you enter your appearance and you can begin your argument.
Thank you. Tessa Ryan for the state. May it please the court. The first line of the criminal commitment statutes reads, whenever it appears that there's a question as to the defendant's competency, any further proceeding in the case shall be suspended until the issue is determined. A legislature was envisioning by saying this that the issue would be determined, not that the court would stop halfway through that determination of competency, as the court here did. The court did that because of the following statutory text, which is at the center of the controversy in this case. The court shall review the defendant's competency and dangerousness every 2 years until expiration of the period of commitment. Here are the reasons, in a nutshell, why the court did not lose jurisdiction. First reason is this court's opinion in Aragon v. Martinez, 2025 decision, which did come out after the district court made its ruling in this case. I think that's notable. It didn't have the benefit of hearing this court's opinion on a similar, very similar subject. That case dealt with indeterminate sex offender parole, and it involved similar statutory text, namely, when a sex offender has served the initial 5 years of supervised parole, the parole board shall review the duration of the parole. So again, we have those words, shall review, and there's a time element. The petitioner in that case made a similar claim, which was that the board's jurisdiction expired due to a late hearing. And because of the late hearing, the tardiness, he was entitled to immediate discharge from parole. This court held that the deadline was not jurisdictional. Why
was that?
That's
not what happened in this case. I mean, March 15 came, and the judge, the district court, strictly construing the statute, says the time has expired. And so she says, the time has expired. As I read Rotherham, she could have held a hearing a few days later or continued the hearing, as long as it was a reasonable amount of time. Whatever she would have decided at that point would have held. But what she did in this case, she strictly construed the statute, which was within her discretion. I assume you agree with that. And then she says, well, because of that, my prior finding of lack of competency remains in effect. So she then said, since he cannot be prosecuted, the case is dismissed. So the issue before us, as I understand it, is not whether she could have held a hearing later on. She ruled that the period had expired. The issue is, what is the effect of the finding of incompetency remaining in effect on the pending criminal case? That is my understanding correct?
Your Honor, you said quite a bit there,
yeah.
So if I may attempt to break it down. She, well, first of all, made clear that she was not dismissing the charges. In her oral ruling, she instructed the parties to produce an order saying that charges weren't dismissed. It's just that I find that I lack jurisdiction to continue this hearing. A bit of a difference there. As to your point about her having the prerogative to interpret the statute, make a ruling on jurisdiction, as we all know, sure, district court judges have to do that kind of thing all the time. But of course, as we all know, those rulings are subject to review by this court, de novo review.
Does Rotherham answer the question for us about not losing jurisdiction? Rotherham suggests that once you kind of hit that terminus, that the other path available is 1.4. And you can the state could pursue civil commitment, or the court can engage in the analysis in 1.4 and say, balancing, all the factors, release, or, there's a variety of avenues there. Doesn't that suggest that jurisdiction isn't lost?
I don't believe so. The statutory text would have to say that. The legislature would have to express that it intended for jurisdiction to be lost.
No, I'm suggesting the statute doesn't say that, right. And Rotherham then takes it to its next logical conclusion, which is then you revert to 1.4. You can't just keep somebody under the criminal commitment statute forever. There is a time limit to it expressed in the text. But that doesn't mean then the judge throws up their hands and says, I can't do anything now. What the judge can do is look to 1.4.
If the hearing is completed and there's a determination on competency, yes, I agree. And if the defendant is found incompetent, still dangerous, 1.4 is the yes.
So is result. That what should that be the remedy? Here is that we instruct Judge Laos to have that competency hearing that they missed. I mean, what's the remedy here? Because it's not just nothing, to my mind. But so what is the something?
The remedy would be anything the legislature intends. If the legislature intended, like in Aragon, for the person at issue, the defendant, the petitioner, the probationer, to be entitled to some kind of recourse based on the tardiness of a hearing, the legislature would have expressed that.
So what, let me just be really clear, you're dancing around. Yeah. What remedy do you want here?
Right.
What are you asking us to do?
Something has to happen with this defendant.
I see.
That's
for this, as the state is concerned, what would the state like to happen next?
Yes.
The state would like an answer to the legal question. As you know, this is a certification proceeding, that the court did not lose jurisdiction.
Jurisdiction to do what?
To continue the hearing.
Which hearing?
Competency hearing, the one section 1.5 competency hearing, which it had started.
The judge already ruled the time had passed, and she ordered him released as provided in 1.5.
That's right.
So, but that doesn't answer what happened. So he's released.
That's right.
He has been released.
Yes.
The state has not sought civil commitment.
That's right.
So the reason, the way I interpret this appeal, and correct me if I'm wrong, you want the criminal case not to be dismissed so that the statute of limitations remains satisfied, but that this man, Mr. Carter, remains under criminal indictment for potentially an indefinite period of time. That's what you're asking for.
No, we're asking that the ruling be reversed so that the
which
court,
ruling? That he
the
be
district
released?
Court's ruling.
So
the district court's
us,
ruling finding that it lacked jurisdiction to continue.
So are you asking us to remand, hold that the district court still had jurisdiction,
yes.
Remand, and continue with the competency hearing?
That is correct, yes.
But that's already been done. The time period expired. He served his 6 years of criminal commitment.
I see. There's still available to the state the opportunity to prosecute crimes that were not accounted for.
So the kidnapping.
Correct. Other crimes. Kidnapping.
So let's then take that step by step, because we're trying to figure out exactly what the state wants here. Mm-hmm. You want us to reverse the district court's decision that she lost jurisdiction, remand. It's not to continue the competency hearing on the charges that have already expired.
No,
okay, that's what we're trying to, like, you've got two buckets.
It is,
you've got kidnapping and everything else. Everything else, the timeline's gone.
Correct.
Okay.
That's right.
That's what I'm trying to
yes.
understand what you want
that
us to
That is
do.
Right. And just to finish the determination on competency, the way the scheme works is that in any case, this defendant, any other defendant, once you reach the end of the period of confinement, there needs to be a hearing on competency. And that's what never finished here. But there's a reason for that, because in this case is one example of where there might still be outstanding charges that the state wishes to prosecute that don't, the 6 years that this defendant served, if you will, in official confinement, doesn't account for those other crimes. There's also the idea that, you know, and this is to be determined, but that the state would prosecute in the interests of justice to bring accountability to a person for having committed a crime. That's kind of a separate matter. This case doesn't really raise the question of whether the state would actually, you know, choose to pursue charges that hadn't been taken into account in that maximum confinement.
There seems to be an argument in the briefing from the defense that because you didn't include kidnapping in the original criminal competency structure, that you have somehow, I guess, waived, or I don't know that you can waive, but waived your ability, the state's ability, to now come back and charge this gentleman with kidnapping.
I believe that the idea comes from the statute, which enumerates certain crimes only, which the legislature has deemed most dangerous. And those are the crimes that are used to calculate the time in confinement. So kidnapping happens to not be one of them. And yes, in this case, the state could pursue.
But it does include a first-degree felony, which kidnapping, first-degree felony with great bodily harm, which kidnapping is
under these facts allegedly.
Can be. I believe in this case, that was not a consideration because, as we know, the court only calculated the 6 years. So that would certainly not include kidnapping first degree.
I think what defendant argues in part is that you stipulated that it was only these things. The state, I don't mean to say you, the state stipulated that it was only these things, and therefore now they can't get another bite at the apple on kidnapping, and I want to know your response to that.
The state did not stipulate to that. So if something like that had happened, it would be in the stipulation order. There's really no text in that order,
that would expressly say that
the state, if you will, like in a plea deal, said we'll drop these charges if you agree to admit that you are dangerous and incompetent.
So Judge Laos, we tell Judge Laos to go back and hold a competency hearing, and she holds it, and rules he's now competent to go to trial. Does it include the charges then in your position for the ones he'd served basically 6 years in commitment for?
I believe it could. There's nothing stopping the state from attempting to prosecute those crimes.
There's no double jeopardy attached, right?
That's right.
It would just be time.
He wasn't facing any jeopardy at all, correct?
That's right. Jeopardy has not yet attached, so theoretically, the state could pursue those charges. Whether it would or not is a different question.
And yes, if they rang the bell, you know, if they were successful in the conviction on those, wouldn't then the defendant be entitled to time served?
Yes, he would.
Okay.
So, credit toward the sentence.
State's not disputing that.
No, that's settled law.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I can point you to the case if you.
So if we remand and it goes back to Judge Laos for a competency hearing and she finds him incompetent again, then what happens?
Then the state can pursue, that is the end of the line, and the state can pursue civil commitment proceedings
under
1.4.
Could they theoretically go back on the kidnapping charges?
Yes.
And proceed under 1.5?
Oh, excuse me. I don't believe so. I think that we've really reached the end of the options as far as the statutory scheme goes. This is it.
Okay.
We got close to finishing, just as you know, did not, because of the timing issue.
And wasn't part of the timing issue that the defense was not ready? There's something in the record that suggests that it was the defense saying we need more time with our expert so that we can fully bring the clash in front of the judge. Is that fair representation of what of the record?
My understanding is that the defense had not had the opportunity to put on its expert. At the second hearing, the state finished with its
So they were ready, they just ran out of time.
That's right.
Okay,
yes,
thank you for that
ran out of time. And I would not pin blame on anyone, frankly, for the delay.
Okay.
It seemed to be on no one's radar until it was.
So I'm a little bit confused. Are you saying that the criminal charges remain pending today?
Yes. They have not been dismissed, so they are pending. Yes.
I see you're out of time, Ms. Ryan. We'll have you back up in a few minutes.
Good.
Thank you. Ms. Solomon? Please enter your appearance and then you can begin.
Jasmine Solomon, on behalf of Mr. Carter, may it please the court. This case turns on the meaning of one express durational limitation in Section 1.5. The court shall review competency and dangerousness every 2 years until expiration of the period of commitment. Mr. Carter's position is straightforward. Expiration means what it says. It marks the end of the court's authority to conduct that review.
Does Rotherham say that?
No,
no,
but a reading of Aragon does, Your Honor. And so under a reading of Aragon, we believe that actually the framework provided by Aragon leads to the opposite result. We're not talking about a two-year review. We're talking about the expiration of the period of commitment. And so the question is, has the state identified any constitutional or affirmative statutory authority for what it asks the court to do after expiration? And it has not. Once a defendant is found incompetent, the court has three options. And here on March 15 of 2024, he was released and expiration of the six-year period of commitment expired. So under a constitutional framework, at expiration, the court retained general subject matter jurisdiction over the criminal case, but the case could not move forward for three reasons, one of them being that due process prohibited it from taking Mr. Carter to trial while incompetent, and its previous finding of incompetency on March 11, 2019 remained unchanged at expiration. Section 1.5 no longer authorized review of an expired period of commitment, and nothing in the act authorized the state to take Mr. Carter back to Section 1.1 and start the competency process again.
Did I understand you correctly that you disagreed with the district court that jurisdiction was lost?
I think that it's perhaps the district court used a term that was, I think, overly broad. What I'm saying is that the court retained general subject matter jurisdiction, but for in what we are arguing is enough jurisdiction to then dismiss the case, for instance, enough jurisdiction to advise the prosecutor perhaps to seek civil commitment. But like I mentioned, there were three reasons the case couldn't move forward. So the court had general subject matter jurisdiction, but it couldn't conduct a competency and dangerousness review hearing for an expired period of commitment, and it couldn't take the incompetent Mr. Carter to trial because its finding on March 11 of 2019 that he was incompetent remained the same. And the act doesn't authorize a 1.1 return and a sequential process that is structured with an endpoint to turn into a recurring loop that it would expose Mr. Carter to possible series or successive periods of commitment
under
1.2.
But he had been determined competent, and that was challenged by the defendant. The determination was he was competent, right?
The determination was by the state expert that he was competent. There were two defense experts that contested that never had an opportunity to testify in front of the court.
Right.
So the court never heard from the defense. And Odyssey reflects that actually Mr. Carter was found incompetent again on January of 2026. So that particular finding is not a foregone conclusion at all at this stage. And the problem with the state's reading of the statute is not only that it disregards an express limitation until expiration creates the obligation and until expiration creates the limit on the shall review obligation.
Can the state go back in under 1.4?
I wouldn't call it a go back in. I would say that
or initiate a proceeding.
Maybe. I don't believe so. I don't believe that. First of all, I would like to just clarify that what hearing are we talking about here? It's important to identify the precise hearing in question. We're not talking about a competency hearing under Section 1.1. We're talking about a competency and dangerousness hearing under 1.5, a hearing that started on June 12th of 2023, resumed on February 21, 2024, and was set to finish on March 29, 14 days after the expiration of the six-year commitment period.
What if we were looking at the statute, the hearing had commenced, like it did here, and the state shut down because of COVID? Are we supposed to throw up our hands and say, well, too bad state?
Well, I would say that this is where Aragon is instructive. Mr. Carter's position is that statutory mandatory deadline of until expiration is a jurisdictional deadline. It is essential to the proper operation of the statute, and it complies with the Constitution and the legislative intent. So under Aragon, what we had, let's change the facts of Aragon and the facts of our case and make the facts of our case apply to Aragon. What we would have is a 20-year parole term, the state trying to hold a parole review hearing, either 20 years and one day or 20 years and 14 days after parole expired. That would clearly not be tenable. I mean, the statutory function of the review hearing is tied to the period of commitment. And so here we have, in a 1.5, which is a competency and dangerousness, not a competency hearing, that is the hearing that was interrupted by the expiration. That hearing is, in essence, a commitment review hearing. And the reason why I say that is because subsection D4 of 1.5 tells us that that review hearing can result in only one of three outcomes. The defendant is competent, the period of commitment ends, and he is released to face trial. The defendant remains incompetent but is no longer dangerous. The period of commitment ends, and he is released.
Right.
And if he remains incompetent and dangerous, the prescribed period of commitment continues.
But that's why I'm struggling with the application of Aragon, because they're two different systems.
Yes.
Right? And that, hold up, please.
Sorry.
That's what Rotherham discusses, and it discusses Jackson and the concerns raised in Jackson and how the competency code balanced the non-criminal proceeding, those concerns that you describe, and balances it out in the competency code. Mm-hmm. That's not Aragon.
I'm sorry?
That is not Aragon.
No, it is not. But our reading of the statute complies with Rotherham and complies with Jackson. Because if the state is allowed to return to a 1.1 competency hearing, then there is nothing to prevent it from subjecting an incompetent and dangerous defendant to a 1.2 commitment to restoration and a 1.5 commitment again under the same charges because he remains incompetent and dangerous.
But I think we are agreeing, I think, maybe not, tell me how you perceive it, that with regard to the 6 years, that time has run, but there's other charges involved in this case that he may be termed dangerous on and not. He, I guess, the defendant may claim competency on or not.
Yeah, what do we do with the kidnapping charges that were not subsumed into this process?
Right. So what we're asking for is an application of Aragon. And I would like to explain why the until expiration is essential to the proper operation of the statute. The legislative intent was to balance three interests: the due process and liberty interest of a defendant, the interest of the state in prosecution, and the public safety interest. It did so in the terms of the statute, and it did so specifically in Section 1.5.
Okay.
It did so through its terms by providing durational limitations for review, treatment, restoration, and commitment, and it did so for the state by providing 1.2 and 1.5 commitments to restoration.
Assume with me that I agree with all of that.
Yeah.
My question was, what do we do with the kidnapping charge that was never applied to the system at all?
To answer,
it's like been held in abeyance somehow.
That's right. So I would like to just, we're asking that those counts be dismissed without prejudice at this point. Had he only been charged...
So if they could refile tomorrow...
That's right.
And they could start the 1.5 proceeding all over again on the kidnapping.
Well, we would argue that no, it would bar that. Because he had one... The legislative intent is to create... And when we look at the act as a whole, we can see that. It is a structured sequential process that moves an incompetent defendant through procedural stages where each stage determines what happens next. And it ends with a 1.4 and 1.5 for defendants who remain incompetent and dangerous, right? So if we're going to read harmoniously 1.4 and 1.5 together through that sequential process with an endpoint, and he had his hearing on March 11, 2019, and the state decided to only proceed on three counts, and we don't know the reason why, perhaps because the statute was different for the kidnapping charges, but there's also an aggravated battery count that they didn't pursue. So at that point, the state made its choice, and it must bear the consequences of its choice.
So you're asked that, then you're ultimately saying dismiss with prejudice the other charges if the state can never pursue the other charges.
What this, no. They can pursue the qualifying charges at the time of the commitment, which would be the AGBAT that was held back and the three counts that he did.
But they can't.
Those are dismissed with prejudice. The other counts that were non-qualifying counts at the time of the commitment hearing are dismissed without prejudice. If the defendant is found competent, they can move. They can proceed.
So I'm not understanding this, because as to the enumerated offenses set forth in the statute, he's incompetent.
Correct.
As to the unenumerated offenses not listed in the statute, he's incompetent.
Correct.
So the way I read this, and it's very simple, and maybe I'm just being too simple, the period of commitment is a period that the legislature has deemed to be reasonable to hold a person incompetent, to treat them to competency, and or make them no longer dangerous.
Correct.
And the legislature has said you do that every 2 years until the expiration of the period of commitment. So the question were that, and all of that happened here. So the question is, now that the period of commitment has expired, the state, as I understand it, is arguing, no, we can go back and we go back to 1.4. We can restart the whole process again, which seems to me completely contrary to due process in holding an incompetent person for an indefinite period of time. When the legislature has said, and I know I'm making a speech and I'm making a point, but the legislature has said, to my mind, in defining these crimes and in setting forth these time frames, says until the expiration of the period of commitment. So I mean, saying this, the enumerated offenses are dismissed with, the unenumerated are without, there's nothing in the statute speaking to that one way or the other. So, I mean, if you're incompetent, you're incompetent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you've been treated for 6 years. There's an issue here as to whether or not he had been, you know, been made competent. And so, and then this question of jurisdiction, to me, the question of jurisdiction is, I understood the state to say jurisdiction to proceed with another competency thing. I thought the issue was the jurisdiction of the court to proceed with a criminal case. Because what they're asking for here is really to hold an open-ended criminal case ad nauseum to infinity until the man dies.
Correct.
If he's never become competent, without the state initiating civil commitment proceedings.
And the defense would agree that what the state is asking is for until expiration to lose all meaning and for no language in the statute to provide for what it's asking for, in essence.
So
Rotherham is respected if we treat the act as a one-way structured process that is sequential with an endpoint.
Well, you still haven't, let me, you keep not answering my question.
I am so sorry.
So, for a variety of reasons, but you have not answered the fundamental question of, okay, so the charge, the underlying criminal commitment qualifying charges, say we agree with you, they are gone. They're the train has left the station. Mm-hmm. We have these other non-qualifying charges. Mm-hmm. The state can still pursue those.
Yes.
Doesn't that then put him under at least some portion of this, namely with Rotherham under 1.4 for a determination of competency? And if he's not competent, because we
1.4 is not just a determination of competency.
You're not even letting me finish my question, so you've got to stop.
Okay.
Okay? Because this is not helpful.
I'm so sorry.
Rotherham says the state can still proceed under either section 331-9-1.4b or 31-9-1.4c. Isn't that the case here with the non-qualifying charges if we dismiss without those things without prejudice?
And I apologize, I was going to get to it. My point is that if Mr. Carter was only charged with the non-qualifying offenses on March 11, 2019, those charges would have been dismissed under 1.4b or c. Because for non-qualifying offenses of a defendant who remains incompetent and dangerous, the court has discretion to either dismiss those charges with or without prejudice. So on March 11, 2019, had he only been charged with those charges, they would have been dismissed on 1.4.
Doesn't the judge have to decide that, not you? I mean, it doesn't happen by fiat. A judge still has to go through the process and then say, gosh, state, civil commitment might be important here.
Sure, the court has discretion.
Leo hasn't done any of that.
The court has discretion to do that as far as civil commitment at any point under 1.4 and 1.5. The moment he remained incompetent and dangerous, then the court had discretion to refer that. The state didn't seek it either. So that was always an option, and in fact, it's an option throughout the act.
And they can do that if the state were to decide to charge him with the kidnapping or the agbat.
Yes.
That's still something that is on the table for the state.
On the table for what, Your Honor?
For civil commitment.
Sure. Civil commitment is always available. Sure. My argument is more to do with criminal competency commitment.
I just want to understand what the path is. That's all I've been asking you about.
So what I'm saying
is the ultimate path here?
Right. So the path is that the court, at the end, at expiration, on March 15, 2024, had general subject matter jurisdiction over the criminal case. But there were three reasons it couldn't move forward. The due process, the Section 1.5 limitation, the statutory function of the hearing is to decide whether the defendant gets released or not. That is the statutory function of that hearing. That is the hearing that was continued. So once that period of commitment expired, there is nothing to continue. There is nothing to review. So that its statutory function ends with expiration. So the hearing that the state is seeking expired. There's no statutory reason for it at that point.
As to the qualifying charges?
As to all the charges.
All the charges. Because
in the same manner that, sorry.
No, I'm just saying, I thought you were saying that the enumerated charges that were stipulated to, mm-hmm. they followed the criminal commitment path.
That's right.
That path is now over as it relates to those charges. Mm-hmm. But as to the unenumerated charges, if the state wanted to bring those again, if we decided it was without prejudice, they wouldn't be subject to the criminal commitment process. It would basically start all over, is I think
what I'm
trying to hear you say.
That's right.
Then the process starts all over.
Right. So by dismissing the qualifying counts with prejudice and dismissing the non-qualifying counts, and when I say non-qualifying counts, I am referring to every count except for the aggravated battery that was not held. All of the non-qualifying counts get dismissed without prejudice. This preserves the state interest in prosecution and does not risk further commitment or successive commitments because there are not qualifying charges. And so, therefore, that is the best outcome that preserves the balance that the legislature intended. So the argument is, yes, the state gets to pursue the kidnapping charges if he is competent. Those go to trial. If he is not competent, then we are done because they had a chance on March 11, 2019, to have their commitment period, and we're not going to have an ex post facto situation where now we're leading to an unjust result for behavior that occurred on 2018.
What would be the period of confinement if they would have brought it with the original charge? What would have been the period of confinement allowable if they would have brought it with the original charge? What would they have added for the kidnapping?
It would have been 9 years instead of six.
Based on
the aggravated battery, great bodily harm was a qualifying charge under the 1999 statute. That is the statute that we're working with.
So the rule you're asking for is for the state in the criminal commitment to bring commitment charges on all the enumerated offenses, or else they would run into the situation we have here.
My first position is that the statutory function for the review ended at expiration. Okay. That all of the qualifying charges cannot be the reason for another run-through, a do-over, or a rewind of the whole act. And so if the state is only considering the possibility that Mr. Carter would be found competent after expiration, and therefore we're fine.
Expiration has to deal with dangerousness, not competency.
It is a competency and dangerousness hearing, but yes, it has to do with the commitment period and whether he will be released. Okay. And so if we're going to allow the state to go back to a section 1.1, and we still have qualifying offenses that are not dismissed with prejudice, those qualifying offenses would then trigger a 1.2 and 1.5 commitment again. There's nothing in the language of the statute, if we defeat the purpose of it being sequential with an endpoint, in preventing that. He's still charged with the same charges.
So I think you're agreeing with what Justice Thompson said, which is the state needs to put up or shut up at the time of pursuing the qualifying charges for 1.5, because otherwise the state would hold back and start the process again, and then suddenly we're at 20 years. Mm-hmm. So I think you were agreeing with Justice Thompson.
Okay, I must have misunderstood the question. I am agreeing.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify.
I am agreeing that it gets dismissed, and I am agreeing that the other ones get dismissed without prejudice. Otherwise, we're dealing with piecemeal litigation or piecemeal application of the act, and that goes against both Rotherham, Jackson, and the legislative intent to have him go over and over through commitment periods with no end in sight.
No question that that the state and or a district court judge should allow, because under the new statute, the kidnapping charges would apply.
Yeah.
And so under the new statute, if the state came to me and said, we're going to stipulate to these two CSC charges and this one Ag Bat charge, but we don't want to address the kidnapping just yet, then a district court judge at that point should say, no, we need to hear all of them that are enumerated right now so that we know what the end point is. And we don't have to keep coming back and forth. That's what you're getting at?
That's what I'm getting at. That would create a loop. That would create a rewind or a do-over. And I would just point out that on March 11, 2019, Mr. Carter was committed to 6 years with 1 year credit with an endpoint of March 15, 2024, that he would have been entitled to two review hearings in that period of time, that the state, one would have started around March of 2021, and the state on April 15 of 2021 reported a change of status, but the hearing didn't start until about more than 2 years later, from April 15, 2021 to June 12, 2023. So that's part of the reason we're in the situation. 2 years later, they started. 8 months later, they resume it. They had about 11 status hearings during that time. It is the state's burden to prove the change of status and its duty to complete a hearing within that period. This is where it is similar to Aragon in the way that we're talking about the two-year review. But it is not similar because what the deadline we're talking about is not the two-year review. That's procedural. That's fine. But the until expiration, that we're arguing is jurisdictional under Aragon because it is essential to the proper operation of the statute. It complies with the terms and the structure and the legislative intent to balance those three interests. It is also required under Aragon and Matthew's three-factor test. Mr. Carter's private interest in his liberty and due process is substantial. The factor two, the risk of erroneous deprivation, is also high if he is allowed to go to a competency hearing and then a 1.2 and 1.5. We're talking about, again, successive commitments. And so both one and two favor Carter. And the third factor...
Counsel, is it your position that if the hearing had happened, it was scheduled on March 11th, which I guess was the last, is that the last day, or March 15th?
March 15,
2024. Okay, let's assume it's scheduled on March 15th, 2024, mm-hmm. and there's a fire at the courthouse, and mm-hmm. they have to move it to March 15th of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge holds the hearing mm-hmm. and finds the defendant competent.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
Well, I would argue, first of all, that the court cannot do that because we're arguing that the deadline is jurisdictional and there's no good cause exception for that. But even if this court found that it was a statutory mandatory deadline, but just procedural and advisory, even under that, it is a deadline that is important to observe and must be strictly adhered in order to protect his due process rights. Because if we find him competent and we're allowing that possibility, we're also allowing the possibility that he will be found to have remained incompetent and dangerous. And this is when we risk running through the statute again. And so therefore that deadline, plus more importantly than anything, is the statutory function of that review hearing. The statutory function is to decide whether the period of commitment continues or not. And so if there's no period of commitment to continue, once it's expired, there's nothing to review or continue. It has no statutory reason to exist.
Then why did the court in Rottingham use reasonable period of time and just not decide it on the statutory deadline?
I would
seems like fairly reasonable people writing this.
Yeah. I would point out that Rotherham doesn't actually deal with the exact issue that we're dealing with and doesn't address it directly. I think that Rotherham establishes that once it examined the act as a whole, it decided that it survived constitutional scrutiny. And so Rotherham and the reading that we have, it does not conflict with that finding of deadlines being procedural. Every single deadline is procedural up until expiration. The two-year review, no one is arguing that we must have that review hearing exactly at the two-year mark. In fact, he didn't have even one complete review hearing in 5 years. So that is not the argument we're making here. We're arguing that until expiration is the deadline that is not advisory or discretionary and is a firm deadline that must be observed to protect his due process rights. Okay, so in conclusion, just to make sure that I've covered everything that I need to cover, I would say that Mr. Carter served 6-year commitment, the maximum allowed, the maximum sentence that was agreed upon on March 11, 2019. That period expired. Had the qualifying offenses been the only offenses he had on that date, they would have been dismissed under 1.4. Under 1.5, if he only had qualifying offenses, he would have been released and there would be no question that he risks further periods of commitment. And it makes no sense that because his indictment combined both charges, that this creates a third category where there is no endpoint in sight and jurisdiction is limitless. If review doesn't end at expiration, the state hasn't answered when does it end. If 14 days is okay, 30 days, a month, there is no statutory authority for it. There's no exceptions, no tolling, no good cause exception or pending hearing exceptions. The state had 2 years and 11 months to conduct that hearing. It failed to do so. The state's own negligence doesn't justify an unreasonable or unconstitutional reading of the statute. And so we would ask at this point that the court find that the district court was correct in finding that it didn't have jurisdiction to conduct the competency and dangerousness hearing. It retained general subject matter jurisdiction, but could not conduct a review hearing that had no statutory function, and that it could not allow the state to conduct a competency hearing under 1.1, and that nothing in the act allows Mr. Carter to start the whole process again. Under Aragon's framework, this maintains the balance of the three competing but related interests of due process, prosecution, and public safety. It allows the state to still pursue the charges for the charges dismissed without prejudice. It prevents unconstitutional series of commitment because the qualifying charges have been dismissed with prejudice. And it still allows for civil commitment if necessary. And of course, if he is subject to conviction after being found competent, I think the state agrees, and we would too, that he is entitled to pre-sentence confinement credit on those. The statute of limitation would, of course, not be triggered anew by the expiration, which is not a bad idea to have the state evaluate whether the case is still viable after all those years. So it's a good policy as well. And then it would be able to proceed on those charges if he's found incompetent and dangerous. Then the charges that are dismissed with prejudice don't expose him to further periods of commitment. And the other charges can be dismissed under 1.4. If we read 1.4 and 1.5 together harmoniously, that is the best outcome. It is consistent with the legislative intent and the constitutional boundaries recognized in Chorney as well.
Thank you, Ms.
Altman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Ryan.
Just to be clear, the state is not asking for anything to restart and not to start back at square one at section 1.1. It is asking simply that this court recognize that the district court did not, in fact, lose jurisdiction as it had believed it had. So jurisdiction to finish the hearing is all we're asking for. The question, answer to that question, I should say, comes from the legislative intent, which is found in the plain language of the statute. Again, the words are, court shall review until expiration of the period of commitment. The shall is mandatory, must do this thing, and it's periodic, must do it over and over. The question is, how long must it do this? The answer is until the expiration of the period of commitment. It was not the legislature's intent to say that a hearing may not be held after that time. The legislature didn't say, and once this period of commitment expires, the court loses jurisdiction. If it had said that, we would concede that the court lost jurisdiction. Those words are simply not there. And Aragon makes clear these same types of points. It's what's not said.
So the court or the party, I mean, whoever could say, okay, I know we're at the end of 6 years and I'm going to set this hearing a year from now and that would be okay?
No, and partly because the court in this case ordered itself to conduct the hearing. So in compliance with
But what if the court ordered itself not to have the hearing until a year after the expiration of the maximum sentence?
That would be problematic. I agree.
Why? Why is that different than one day or 5 days or a year? What's the principled distinction there?
One reason is that I heard the words essential to the proper operation of the statute. These words are not essential to the proper operation of the statute. The defendant in this case was released. If his release were tied to this hearing and its outcome, that would be a different story. This is simply guideline.
It wasn't?
No. The defendant was released from commitment. He's not in state confinement anymore. And the only question at that time was whether he was competent to stand trial.
She walked, and then that's where she said, I lack jurisdiction, I'm out on both. I'm out on him being dangerous, even though he's out. and I'm out on the competency, even though all we have left are defense witnesses.
Yes, and looking back, the judge arguably wasn't fully informed, didn't have a full picture. This issue came up shortly before the hearing, and the state had not put in writing any kind of response to the defendant's arguments. So we look at what the court was relying on to make this conclusion, and they're primarily the statutory text, which does not have firm direction or, you know, firm instruction that she should conclude that she's lost jurisdiction.
It says shall and until.
Shall hold the hearings.
Yeah.
Agree, until. That is a mandatory duty. And the until is an until. Indication of when to stop.
So let me see if I approach it a different way, if that'll help me understand your argument more clearly. So assume with me that the hearing was held until completion. So the whole thing happened at 5 years, 363 days. And at that point, the judge says the finding is incompetent and dangerous. What happens next?
Then either the state can pursue civil commitment or nothing.
So you would agree that had Judge Leos done all of this and said dangerous and incompetent, knowing that the 6 years is going to elapse, you know, in like 48 hours or something like that, then it would put us back into the civil commitment process.
Yes, and that's the statutory scheme. The language makes that clear.
And if she found him competent at that same time, what happens?
He would be subject to prosecution under the charges. And that's the whole point of the hearing, to determine whether he is or is not.
So your whole complaint is that she didn't finish the hearing?
That's essentially it. That was her conclusion.
Well, not essentially. I'm asking, is that your argument, is that she should have completed the hearing?
Yes,
so that you would know how to proceed.
Even though nobody told her about Rotherham or anything else?
She should have completed the hearing.
And you say she was going by the language of the statute.
I believe she was partly that, but also, I mean, the two key analogies that defense counsel brought to her attention were the probation context and the criminal sentencing context, which is, I've explained in my brief, I'm happy to continue explaining if you wish, but those are two distinguishable situations. They're not the same. So to your point, why did the judge make this ruling? The state believes that's really at the center of this case. It's not whether the state has authority to do anything. It's whether the judge in this case erred in making that ruling.
And the state's pursuing this because it still believes that the defendant is competent and they want to proceed to criminal trial?
Yes, they will acknowledge that at this point, because so much time has passed, it's entirely possible that there will have to be a restart.
But you'd have to have that point of view.
That's
or
right.
Why bother with all of this and not just pursue civil commitment?
Yes.
Because with my hypothetical of that, you know, like right up against the deadline, that would be the remedy in any event. So the state must have some interest here in trying to see if he is competent.
The state concluded he was competent, and it was challenged.
State's experts said as much, and yes, there was a challenge, so that's the question in the air.
Is the state required, it's kind of a separate question now, just on my mind, is the state required to, when bringing the competency and dangerousness, like I want them committed because they're dangerous, are they required when starting that hearing to advise the court of each charge upon which they rely so that the court can decide what the reasonable time is. Still says reasonable, but the guidelines are for the period of commitment before that individual has to be released or civilly committed?
I don't. There is a rule on this, how this all works. I don't think it speaks to what the state must do. My presumption would be that the court would know what charges are outstanding and have every reason to believe that the state intends to prosecute those charges. And then it's a matter of whether they fall within the list of crimes that the maximum period of commitment is calculated on or not.
Does the record tell us why the hearing was not? The hearing commenced on June the 12th, 2023, but it did not recommence until February 21 of 2024. Is there any explanation for that delay in the record?
I wondered the same thing. I tried to understand. It sounds like the judge was waiting for responses on available dates by counsel. Neither of them was very responsive to her questions, and eventually she kept prodding, and eventually they did answer. I think part of the difficulty was that this involved experts, so we're not just talking about counsel and their schedules. They had to coordinate. I really couldn't tell you beyond that why it took so long.
So where does that place the scale?
Are you asking whether the idea...
This delay that's unexplained, mm-hmm. What does that do here in this case? Where do we weigh that delay?
Well, it would technically, had they finished the hearing at the February setting, there wouldn't be a problem.
Right.
I mean, so it began, it resumed,
right.
It...
We go from February until March 15 of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an unexplained delay. How do we weigh that?
I don't know that it needs to be weighed. I think the question is whether the court lost jurisdiction to continue.
Well, let me read something to you from Rotherham. Mm-hmm. It says, when neglect by the state leads to unreasonable, lengthy commitment, delay will not be excused.
That delay refers to the commitment.
The
commitment itself. If there's some type of, all I can say is that in this case, the relationship between the hearing and the commitment is non-existent.
The court is talking about the system of hearings with the time limitations. And within that context of that discussion, the court says, when neglect by the state leads to unreasonable, lengthy commitment, which in this case he was held in commitment, delay will not be excused.
He was released, whether the hearing...
On the 15th.
Correct.
Between February and March, he was in custody.
Until the 15th. He would have been in that in the custody.
As they finished the hearing on the 12th and found... he would have been released or detained.
I see. So you're wondering if the hearing had finished on the 12th.
No, I'm saying the hearing was not finished on the 12th.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no explanation as to why it wasn't held before the 15th. That delay, if I'm reading Rotherham correct, cannot be excused.
I think Rotherham was referring to a delay in holding a person confined, which is not the delay here. The delay here is just in the hearing. Whether
we may disagree on that. But anyway.
I think one of the questions I'm hoping you can help us answer, Ms. Ryan, is if we find that Rotherham is the guidance that we're looking for here, and we have to look at, okay, how much delay? We're going to allow a little bit of delay. How do we measure the amount of delay that's tolerable? Here we had a 2-week delay between the time that the defendant was scheduled to be released and the time Judge Leo scheduled that final hearing. Is a 2-week delay all right? How do we figure out if that's okay? or should we be looking at it that it's only a two-day delay? Is a two-day delay is okay. A one-month delay is okay. How do we measure that?
Compton might be one source you could turn to for that. In that case, this is New Mexico Department of Health v. Compton, which is very analogous. And also, this court held in that case that the deadline was not jurisdictional, same type of claim. In that case, it was 14 days also, coincidentally. In a different context, civil commitment, but still arguably far more sensitive in terms of the dates. So this man had been confined beyond his will, and the hearing, which was supposed to have been held promptly to determine whether it should continue, couldn't happen because the judge got sick. This court held that this was not a jurisdictional provision. The legislature didn't intend for someone to be released simply because the hearing was held late. I will point out that Compton, Aragon agree with that conclusion. There's also the New Mexico Court of Appeals opinion in State v. Cooley, 2023 case. I would point you to a U.S. Supreme Court case. This was not cited in the brief, but additional authority. United States v. Montalvo Murillo, 495 U.S. 711, and that's from 1990. Reaches very similar conclusions on many of these same subjects that have been raised. I encourage you to take a look at those. I will wrap up by saying that this court can be assured that the district court here did not lose jurisdiction because that conclusion is wholly consistent with its prior decisions in Compton, Aragon. Cooley, U.S. Supreme Court precedent. May I continue? I'll wrap up briefly. A multitude of secondary sources and case law from other jurisdictions, the statutory text at issue, and its lack of suggestion that the legislature intended any loss of jurisdiction in this circumstance, and finally, the general rule that a loss of jurisdiction won't be read into a statute where, like here, the legislature does not explicitly provide for it. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you for your briefing and thank you for the lively discussion. We will take this matter under advisement and get you an opinion as soon as we are able. Court is in recess.
Attend the court, please.